Hello and welcome to the Big Happy Life podcast. I'm Natalie Britt and I'm a coach, trainer, and hypnotherapist. The work that I do with clients and with groups is generally about helping people experience life in a way that feels more rewarding. And I particularly work with parents who are looking to break cycles that they don't wish to pass to their children. Most of us want happiness, contentment, confidence for our kids. We want them to live lives they feel great living. But a lot of us don't fully understand how to do that for ourselves. And that's really what my work is all about. Largely because I need it for myself, but I think we all need it. And what my work has kind of taught me is that there are four pillars, if you like, that come with wellness. Those are neuroscience, nutrition, habits, and healing. This episode deals specifically with the neuroscience pillar, although you'll see as we go through that it touches on many of the others too, because in order to have a healthy brain, we have to have good nutrition and we have to have good habits. They will determine the health of our brain. But the health of our brain will also determine our ability to experience happiness. So there's a kind of feedback loop that's at play. And that's really what this episode helps address. So if you want to understand what's really going on in your brain when you feel the way you feel, and how do you end up with a healthier brain so that you can feel happier more of the time, then this episode is for you. Much of the content you're going to hear in this episode was actually recorded for episode 25, which went out a couple of years ago. But since first recording that episode, I have obviously gone on to do more research, I've gone on to do more learning, I've developed my practices, and I've worked with more clients. And so my understanding of the subject has deepened. So what I've done is I've left the original episode, but I have kind of spliced it and added new pieces in, little updates throughout, to share with you the additional information that I've gathered over the years to help round out the picture and share a little bit more information that may be of use to you in terms of understanding A, what's happening in the brain, and B, what you potentially could do to address certain balances that may make it easier for you to have that greater sense of happiness, reward, contentment in life, or possibly reduce some of the symptoms of mental ill health, low mood, low energy, even symptoms of mild depression. All of these things could potentially be addressed. So if all of that is of interest to you, stick around, let's dive in. One of the most difficult questions to answer in the world is, what is happiness? So rather than trying to work it out philosophically, one of the easier ways to consider it is to think about what's actually happening in our brains and bodies when we experience it. Because that takes a little bit of the subjectivity out of it. It helps us look at the trends and the patterns. You know, what's happening in most people most of the time when they experience happiness. And then with that information, we could start looking at our own habits and think, if I do more of this, will I experience more pleasure, more happiness, more contentment? Using that information, we can make changes in our lives and hopefully experience something more rewarding. So in this episode, we're looking at four neurochemicals or brain chemicals. I'm just going to call them brain chemicals rather than neurotransmitters or hormones, because some of them are neurotransmitters, some of them are hormones, some of them are hormones that act like neurotransmitters, some of them are believed to be neurotransmitters by some people and believed to be hormones by other people. So we're just not going to open that can of worms. We're going to call them brain chemicals. The four that we're going to look at are dopamine, serotonin, oxytocin, and endorphins. And each of them plays a different role in our experience of pleasure and happiness. Far from being a science lesson, this episode is really just about providing a basic understanding of what these four chemicals do, how they affect your behavior and how you feel, and what implications that has for how you set your life up and the things you focus on and do in order to feel happier. Understanding these four chemicals helps you get a sense of why technology might be robbing you of your happiness, why you feel better when you exercise, and why having people you can hug makes a difference to your happiness. So we'll start with dopamine. Dopamine is a wily little mischief maker. I say that because although dopamine makes a very important contribution to the way our brains experience happiness and the way we experience pleasure, it can also get in the way of us enjoying some of the other, more stable experiences associated with happiness. Dopamine promotes novelty-seeking and reward-seeking behavior. In evolutionary terms, it played a really important role because it's the chemical that would grab our attention and go, "Hey, look over there, that's a berry we haven't tried before. Maybe we can eat the berry." So that kind of arrested attention, stopping you in your tracks and getting you to look at the new thing, anticipate how rewarding it could be, and stop what you're doing to go and seek it out, had massive survival implications. Assuming you could, in fact, eat the berry. Otherwise, probably not. But even then, massive survival implications for everybody else. But of course, when you think about something that does that to your brain in the world we live in today, you can see how problematic it has the potential to become. Hey, look over here, you've got a new text message. Wait, something's happening on Instagram. Ooh, somebody's just liked your post on Facebook. Hey, you just got a new email. Ooh, your friend's just logged onto the video game. You could play that now. Is that chocolate cake I smell? If you've ever seen the movie Up, dopamine is the thing that goes, squirrel! So that kind of arrested attention, stopping you in your tracks, is problematic in itself, but it gets worse. Until recently, dopamine was associated with pleasure. So we thought that it fired when you experienced pleasure. But more recent studies suggest it's actually the anticipation that makes dopamine fire, which means once you've experienced the thing you thought was going to be pleasurable, dopamine stops firing and you need another hit, which means it's time to move to another new thing. Again, when you think about it in evolutionary terms, it's not that problematic because those new things weren't coming along as often as they do in our world today. But when you think about dopamine working in this way, to go, "Ooh, that thing could make you feel better, try that. Oh, it didn't work. Do something else, or do it again, it'll work next time." And so that constant driving for new and more and faster can keep you stuck in that loop. If you listened to episode 2, you might be familiar with the term hedonic treadmill, where you do these things that you expect to experience pleasure from, and they ultimately feel unrewarding, so you have to do something more, or you have to do something again. That's dopamine. It's thought to be behind many addictive behaviors, addictions to technology, addictions to sex, alcohol, drugs, food. Now, of course, with many of those addictions, there are other factors at play. It's not just dopamine, but it's important to recognize the role that dopamine could play in getting to the point where those things have enough of a hook in you to become addictive. And certainly with addictions to things like technology, where there's no other substance involved, you probably are looking at somebody who then is a bit too reactive to that pull of dopamine. Okay, so here's the first of those updates that I told you would be in this episode. Since first recording the episode, I have learned a bit more about dopamine and how it works. So according to the work of Dr. Anne Lemke, who wrote a book called Dopamine Nation, our brains, with repeated dopamine stimulus, we actually reduce the brain's ability to respond properly to dopamine. In other words, we get less and less of a hit from it. So that ties in with the whole hedonic treadmill thing. You know, you need to do more of it. You need to eat more of the thing. You need to more regularly engage with whatever the rewarding behavior is. And so we see that in addiction patterns. But the piece that we now understand in more detail is that there's a sort of dopamine sensitivity baseline, a kind of what it takes for us to experience pleasure baseline, if you like. And the more repeated and frequent dopamine hits we get, the more that baseline is increased. In other words, you won't feel good with the same hit that you got before. But that's not just in relation to the specific behavior that was giving you the dopamine hit in the first place. So in other words, if we say, you know, wine gives you masses of pleasure. So what we already understood about dopamine was if you keep drinking wine, you need more and more of it to get that sense of pleasure and that sense of reward that would have come initially from the first couple of sips. But what we didn't know was that the brain's dopamine receptors and that baseline is changing. And so the same problem will kind of become more generalized. So it won't just be affected by wine. It will be, you don't get as much pleasure from other things that previously would have given you pleasure. And not only that, but the sort of sensitivity to pain, psychological pain, discomfort, boredom, frustration, emotions that we find more challenging, that in conjunction seesaws in the opposite direction. So now we need more pleasurable stuff to feel even the most basic sense of enjoyment, pleasure, or happiness. But we are wildly more sensitive to the negative side of the emotional equation. So it really doesn't take a lot to knock us off balance. And when we get knocked off balance, of course, we generally then return to the habits because we're seeking the dopamine hit. So we do more of the things that bring pleasure. But over time, what that's doing is it's repeatedly changing the brain's baseline ability to experience any kind of reward. And it's also increasing our sensitivity to negative psychological experiences. So we become more easily stressed, more reactive, more irritable, more easily frustrated, more easily bored. And then the kind of suffering that we experience around those emotions is escalated. And we can't easily medicate through the habits that previously made us feel better because our dopamine baseline is so high. So we need more and more. And that's really the key with this one is when we stick with pleasure-seeking behaviors to try and increase our ability to experience a true sense of happiness, what we eventually create is this kind of spiral that gradually draws us downwards, further into more anxious-type behaviors, more depressive-type experiences, and feelings that kind of over time drag us down. And I think for a lot of us, that's where we get stuck. Once, you know, we've done all this work and we've built our lives and we have a certain element of comfort, a certain element of stability and security, and we find ourselves gradually feeling less and less happy. This is, for many of us, the place to start looking, is redressing the dopamine balance. And so one of the ways we can do that is by increasing our tolerance for the more uncomfortable emotions. So when we experience boredom or frustration, learning techniques that help us come through those things, mindfulness, meditation, those types of things can give us the tools we need to manage that kind of psychological imbalance, that psychological discomfort. Also, increasing little bursts of controlled stress. This is called hormesis. It's where the body is exposed to shorter bursts of more positive stress. So things like cold showers, intermittent fasting, things like that, that do put the body under stress. Exercise is also a form of hormesis. The kinds of things that put the body and the brain under an element of stress, but it's controlled stress and you are sort of engaging with it mindfully and deliberately, those kinds of things can help reset the balance in conjunction with decreasing the exposure to dopamine spiking behaviors. So bringing down the exposure to social media, bringing down the exposure to different foods that are dopamine spiking, alcohol, all those kinds of things. Often it's easier to make those sorts of changes with a change to environment. So if you are wanting to cut down on a particular habit that you know is dopamine spiking, then reducing your exposure to the habit in the first place is easier than putting yourself in constant contact with that habit and then having to use willpower to not engage with it. So you might buy one of those phone safe lock things if it's social media that's kind of your big dopamine spiker. So you get the phone locked away in one of those things for a particular number of hours that you specify. You can't get it out for that time. And then you can't be tempted by it because it's locked away and it's done. And that way you don't have to keep going, okay, I'm not going to touch my phone. I'm not going to touch my phone. Same with if your house is full of tempting foods and food is your dopamine spiker, then maybe get that stuff out of the house so you're not constantly exposed to it. Sure, you can go to the shop and you can buy more, but you're not constantly being bombarded as you sit on the sofa with images of what's in the cupboard or what's in the fridge and then having to talk yourself out of going to get it. So those are the kinds of things that you can begin to do to start redressing the balance. Something else that I learned recently about redressing the dopamine balance and getting the receptors in the brain working again the way that they need to. This was the work of Dr. Mindy Pelz, and she wrote a book called Fast Like a Girl. And one of the things that she talked about is after a certain number of hours without food, the dopamine receptors and the dopamine pathways begin to reset. In the show notes for this episode, I've included a link to a video where she talks about the dopamine fast, but effectively it is 48 hours without food that allow the dopamine pathways to reset. Now, there's a whole protocol to get you up to 48 hours. You need to follow Dr. Mindy for the advice and the help on how to build up to going 48 hours without food, because your body needs to be able to switch from using glucose as a fuel source to using fat as a fuel source. And it takes a little bit of time for the body to adapt to being able to do that. So you can't just jump in at 48 hours. But in the show notes, you'll find all the resources you need to begin figuring that out if that's something you want to look into. So Dr. Mindy Pelz, Fast Like a Girl, and I've also put the YouTube video that's just about the dopamine fast, also by Dr. Mindy Pelz. You'll find everything that you need in the show notes at bighappylife.co.uk. Okay, so that's it for the extra information. Now back to the original episode. The next three chemicals we look at last longer in the system and provide a different type of stimulus. The next one we look at is serotonin. The effects of serotonin are more subtle than the effects of dopamine. It's more associated with contentment than it is with excitement or stimulation. It's sometimes called the happy chemical because it appears to play a part in mood regulation, and low levels of serotonin are associated with depression. But what's not really clear at this point is whether you end up depressed because you've got low serotonin levels, or whether you end up with low serotonin levels as a result of being depressed. Either way, when you have too little of it, you don't feel great. When levels of serotonin are low, of course, you end up with low mood, but also things that are affected are you have trouble sleeping, you have reduced memory function, you tend to experience pain more easily, and you crave sweet and starchy foods. That last one makes a lot of sense when you think about the fact that although serotonin is referred to as a brain chemical, its building blocks actually start in the gut. So some of the foods you eat cause chemical reactions that actually cause the body to produce serotonin. And in the absence of those chemical reactions, you end up with less of it. Okay, another little update here. In the original episode, alluded to the impact of the gut on serotonin levels. But since the original episode, I have gone so deep down this rabbit hole that it's kind of blown my mind. And the more I've learned about the gut, the more I think all mental health issues have a significant gut component. That if the gut is unhappy, we will be unhappy. Like, it seems to be that simple. One of the things I've learned is that you as a person are only approximately 50% human. The other 50% is bacteria. Bacteria that exists in your gut, bacteria that exists on your skin. And there are trillions, literally trillions of them, and they all talk to each other and they signal the brain. They can change hormone balances, they can change neurotransmitters, they can create cravings, because they have roles to play in the body's pharmacy. So the easiest way to think about this is your body has effectively its own pharmacy, its own science lab, right? And if you imagine, you know, shelves and shelves and shelves, go back to your science lab at school and think about all the different stuff. If you looked around that room, there were these jars and bottles and things all around the room. Now, the components that we need for a healthy, happy body and brain are the ingredients and the things that exist in these jars. And we have two ways that we can get all the different things that we need in the jars. One, we can eat the things that have those compounds in them. And two, we can produce them in our bodies. So if the chemical is going to come from our food, number one, we have to eat the foods that have that particular compound in them. And then we have to be able to extract the compound from the food. and that relies on gut bacteria. So if we don't have the right gut bacteria, we can eat the right foods, but we might not be able to extract the nutrients from them, which means the jars on those shelves that would have had those things inside are now empty, which means the various reactions or the various processes that we want to create that require that ingredient will not take place. By the same token, if it's a product that the body has to produce, normally the production is happening based on, you know, something plus something else. The body puts these two things together and produces another compound that it then uses, or it turns something we've eaten into something we then use for another process. So we take things from two jars, we put them together in a test tube, and we create something else that then gets stored in a third jar, effectively. Again, we require bacteria in the right proportions to be able to have these chemical reactions take place the way that they're meant to. So no matter which way we slice it, it comes back to gut health. And again, this is far too big a subject to explore in any massive depth here, but the learning for me has been, if there is something wrong with my mental health, something is not working well in my body, and one of the best places I can start to address that is to begin to think about my gut health. And gut health can be thought about in two different ways. It's not just the foods that we eat. I have a podcast episode about the gut where I spoke to Hannah Richards, author of The Best Possible You. She is a gut specialist. She runs the Gut Clinic, and she has some fantastic advice where she talks about the fact that it's not the food that we have to worry about so much. It's the health of the gut. And one of the ways we can start to repair the gut is through changes in diet, but there are other things we also have to do to heal the gut if it is not functioning correctly. We can't just, you know, jump in and start eating kale and broccoli and expect things to suddenly miraculously heal. Again, link in the show notes and the description of this episode for access to that original conversation with Hannah Richards if you'd like to listen to more detail about the gut. And with that, back to the original episode. The next chemical to talk about is oxytocin. This one is sometimes referred to as the love hormone. It's responsible for connection and bonding, and it's associated with the bond between mother and infant. That absolute rush of love you get, that's oxytocin. And the cool thing about it is that it actually changes the way genes are expressed. In other words, it changes the way your genes perform in your body. So the effects of it can literally last for years, which, when you consider toddler behavior, is probably quite useful. And any physical contact for long enough can top up oxytocin. So all those gorgeous cuddles and lovely hugs you have with your kids, your partner, your friends, all of those have the capacity to release oxytocin. And therefore, the more contented physical contact you experience, the more likely it is that those levels of oxytocin stay topped up. I remember reading a few years back in a parenting book that you should hug your child a minimum of 12 times a day. And it's probably something to do with this release of oxytocin. So they experience this contentment, and it kind of stimulates that brain healthy sense of contentment that comes from physical connection with a loved one. That type of physical connection can also lift the mood, and therefore can also boost levels of serotonin. Another little update, interruption here, because I've looked into this a little bit more, and some of the research that I've read, predominantly done with mice or rats, but that researchers and scientists believe does inform our understanding of what's happening in humans as well, is that when you take a mouse or a rat away from its mom and you starve it of that physical contact, that mouse or rat develops mental health issues. It also develops digestive issues, and it responds poorly to food, to stimulation. It becomes less creative, less able to solve problems. It's less resilient, more reactive. And so there seems to be a link in terms of how the brain develops and what the brain is capable of doing that is altered by physical touch and closeness. And when you think about it, it does kind of make sense, because in any animal that is geared to form relationships and stay close with others, there would be a kind of survival implication of being pushed out or rejected. And so the brain of that animal has to be able to detect the positiveness of closeness and recognize that it is now in an environment where it can thrive, and then can switch on the mechanisms that allow thriving to take place. Whereas if that thriving isn't detected, if the animal is in kind of survival mode and stress mode of like, this is really wrong and I might die because my source of care has been shut off and I can't care for myself. All of the mechanisms that the brain and body would switch on in a thriving environment are not switched on because it's not safe to do so. And that kind of explains a lot of my understanding around the effect of trauma on the brain. Of course, if you've listened to this before, you know that I'm an adoptive parent. And so a lot of what started me on this journey in the first place was understanding what's happening to and within my children and their brains as a result of early life trauma. And it's really interesting to see how early life trauma can impact what happens to a child and how that child develops. And I think a lot of the precursor to that is oxytocin. And that may also explain why children who've experienced early life trauma and who may have not had enough exposure to oxytocin or enough production of oxytocin in their systems would be more susceptible to and more at risk of mental health conditions that affect other molecules like serotonin and dopamine. So children who've experienced early life trauma are more at risk of developing addictions, more at risk of developing depression, anxiety, bipolar disorder, any of those other conditions, all of which have a neurochemical element to them. But if they're underpinned by this necessity for oxytocin, that kind of explains it. And so it's also one of the reasons why things like loneliness can literally be life-threatening. Because if oxytocin drops and we feel so disconnected, it has this massive knock-on effect to all of the others. And so I think this is one of the reasons why when we look to improve our mental health, when we look to increase our happiness, we have to do so in the context of really positive, loving, rewarding relationships, because without oxytocin, the other chemicals don't come online either. So that's another piece of the puzzle that helps us understand the picture of happiness within the brain. And now back to the original episode one last time. Then finally, we have endorphins. The word endorphins comes from endogenous, meaning in the body, and morphine, which is an opiate or pain reliever. So endorphins are natural pain relievers. If you're someone who already takes care of your fitness, then the likelihood is you're familiar with endorphins. But what you may not know is that not only do they reduce pain, they also kind of cycle back in to release extra dopamine, which means they are heightening pleasure at the same time. So that can explain concepts like the runner's high, that kind of buzz and real pleasure you get after doing exercise. Endorphins fire during times of stress and pain, and also during activities like eating and sex. So when you think about the fact that endorphins are released as a natural painkiller, it's easier to understand how something like overeating and the discomfort that comes with that could ultimately end up with a pleasure sensation associated with it and could cause you to do it again. And perhaps may explain behaviors like S&M or self-harm and how we experience pleasure as a result of pain, because the brain chemistry can support that sort of link. And endorphins aren't just linked to physical pain, they also can alleviate social pain, which again, when you think about it in evolutionary terms, makes sense, because people who were able to overcome social anxiety, to stick together, to work in groups, increased their chances of survival. And since humans naturally seek pleasure and avoid pain, it makes sense that this loop is created. So when you're experiencing pain and endorphins are released, it can loop back in, you can experience pleasure, and you can push through the pain barrier, be that physical or social. And actually, just listening back to that piece, having just recorded the update about dopamine, that sort of dropped another piece of the puzzle in for me as well, because it explains what might be happening when we engage in behaviors that are all about hormesis, that deliberate stressor. that it may be firing endorphins, which is potentially what is helping us access that dopamine pathway or potentially reset the baseline. Like there could be a loop in play here that's making those two things offset each other. I'll need to look into that a little bit further, but just thought I'd throw that into the mix. So those are the four chemicals most commonly associated with pleasure, with pain relief, and with contentment, all things required to experience happiness. In a world where we lived with few distractions and we lived and worked in small communities or tribes, this system worked perfectly. But in a modern world where we could literally go days or weeks without interacting physically with another person, in a world where safeguarding rules make it impossible for a teacher to hug a child, and where our friendships are giving us little hits of dopamine because we are experiencing them via Facebook or Instagram instead of in person, we're robbing ourselves of the chance to release serotonin, oxytocin, and endorphins. So what this basic understanding of these four chemicals allows us to do is to look at our habits and consider how much time are we spending giving ourselves little dopamine hits instead of allowing serotonin, oxytocin, and endorphins to give us a much more balanced, longer lasting feeling of contentment because we're hugging each other, talking to each other, eating the right foods, sleeping well, and exercising. The more balance we have across these activities, the better we're likely to feel. Now, this probably isn't news, but hopefully what this episode does is it tells you a little bit about why this stuff works and also gives you a sense of what might get in your way. So having listened to this, if you think actually dopamine is a big player in your life and you are novelty seeking, reward seeking consistently to get that hit after hit after hit, but it's robbing you of the chance to spend the time you need to spend in order to experience some of the others, then you can start looking at your habits and assess what would you add, what would you change, what would you stop, so that you ultimately end up feeling more contented. If you found this episode helpful or interesting, I'd love for you to share it with friends and other people who you think might also be interested in listening. I would love for you to leave a review. It really helps reach a wider audience. And I invite you to hit the subscribe button so that you can be notified of new episodes when they become available. If you have questions or you'd like me to record an episode about something particular that you feel will help you in the area of neuroscience, nutrition, habits, or healing, leave a comment, get in touch. You can email me natalie@bighappylife.co.uk and ask your question there, and I can record the episode for you. For now though, thanks for listening.